Chapter 5. Stop trying to control the outcome. Focus on your behavior and actions instead. Some years ago, I was unwinding with one of my best and most successful students at the time, a salesman, and he told me the following story. "You know, Jim, I have a prospect in my area that I called on for more than 2 years. Around 8:30 in the morning on the first Monday of each month, I'd stop by and see him. A really nice guy, but I thought he'd never buy from me. He always seemed unable to focus on the issues. To tell the truth, it was frustrating, and I only called on him because he was so close to where I lived. It was convenient. He was part of my monthly plan. One week I was on my way home one afternoon with a little time to spare, and I decided to stop by and see this man. And he was a different guy. He was focused, he acknowledged he had some problems we could fix, and he gave me my first order right then. I was shocked. After we finished the paperwork, I had to ask him, why today? What had brought him to buy from me on that day? He said, well, I'm diabetic, and it takes me a couple of hours in the morning to get my blood sugar under control. I have trouble getting started until about 10 in the morning. Come to think of it, I don't think I ever placed an order until the afternoon, probably out of habit. I appreciate your continuing to come and see me. Ouch. 2 years. In Chapter 8, we'll look at the mistake my client made that caused this negotiation to take that long in the first place. But the point for our discussion now is that not one of those visits was wasted time, and this would have been true even if he hadn't eventually signed the deal. Our subject now is goals. Just as with mission and purpose, I believe in these tools, but call for a very different approach from the usual one. My clients do not set sales targets, quotas, numbers, percentages. Never. Instead, they set goals they can control. So, what can we control? If you're able to answer this question and really internalize that answer, you're way ahead of most people, including many professional negotiators. When I ask this question in workshops and seminars, only a few people will answer ourselves. This is the correct answer, but only partially. Can we manage our heart rate, for example? I've read that certain monks of a high caliber can do so, but most of us cannot. Can we control our anger following an insult? Not really, not the emotion itself. Time? Can we control time? Well, we can't alter the fact that there are only 24 hours a day to work with, and some of these will be lost to sleep. But we can control what we do during our waking hours and how we do it. By this progression, we arrive at the real answer to what we can control about ourselves: behavior and activity. Or as I sometimes put it, an action or effort to an end. Your anger following an insult is not under control, but your behavior is. You decide whether to strike back in some way or to turn the other cheek. In your life, in your negotiations, you develop habits of behavior, good and bad, and you have activities that you pursue that help or hinder you. Everything else, everything, including all results, we might as well think of as acts of God. If my client's goal had been to sell his product to his diabetic customer, he would have given up. But that would never have been his goal, because the actual sale was an end over which he had no control, and no one in his right mind would set a goal over which he had no control. Or would he? Of course he would. It happens all the time in the business world, and in our private lives as well. I'd even say that most companies, professionals, and individuals set performance goals that are really results over which they have no control, and which they fail to meet time after time after time. I've spent years in front of thousands of negotiators in straight sales, men and women who may earn $750,000 a year in commissions, students in college preparing for their first real job, top executives of Fortune 500 companies. I've coached the negotiations of some of the most successful service and academic institutions in the world. Invariably, no matter the background, all of these good people want the same thing: results. But when I ask them to identify the behaviors and activities required of their negotiation or sales teams, they don't know. They can't do it. All they know is that on every sales team there is, and has to be by definition, the top seller or the top negotiator, no matter the market condition, no matter the difficulty of the negotiation. Why can't everyone deliver results like that? Well, many more of us can. but only if we understand the difference between a goal and a result, between what we can and cannot control. Control what you can control. Forget the rest. What goals did you set prior to sitting down with this book and thinking at greater length about the art and science of negotiation? You probably didn't set any. That's fine. Most people wouldn't. No one said you had to. But I suggest that now you think about your goal for this undertaking. If I were a beginner in the study of decision-based negotiation, as opposed to emotion and compromise-based negotiation, my initial goals would be to focus at all times on my mission and purpose, to control my neediness and never demonstrate neediness, to always allow my adversary to be okay, to have no fear of saying or hearing no, the subjects of the preceding chapters. Right there, you have four very straightforward, obtainable, valid goals that, if carefully followed, would make you an excellent negotiator relative to the field. But the real point I want to get across here is the distinction between a goal and a result, or objective as it's commonly labeled. Goals you can control. Objectives you cannot. By following your behavioral goals, you get to your objectives. One last time. Instead of trying to break par, or bogey more likely, a result we cannot control, we concentrate on putting a good swing on the ball, an action we can control. The distinction is crystal clear, surely, but it never ceases to amaze me that the same folks in my workshops who nod their heads in agreement with the golf analogy turn right around and announce that their goal in this negotiation is to sign the deal and collect the money. So I ask you again, is this signing and collecting something that you can actually manage and control? You can attempt to influence someone else's decision to help them see, but can you manage the final decision itself? Not if this is a genuine negotiation in which both parties have the right to say no. You can't forge the adversary's signature. Or think about it this way. After you've led the horse to the water, can you make it drink? The old adage says no, and the old adage is right. As you work through these lessons and apply them to your business and your life, you'll develop a keen awareness of exactly what you can and cannot control, and therefore what is and is not a valid goal. What you can control is behavior and activity. What you cannot control is the result of this behavior and activity. Think behavior. Forget result. Should someone exhort you, "Go get 'em, gang, make something happen, stir the pot, go for the jugular, close, close, close," you should ignore this yelling and screaming. If you think this individual is worth the effort, you should point out why these are not valid goals. And if you don't think this individual is worth the effort, but you're stuck with him or her as a manager or colleague, you should think seriously about a new venue for your labors. Because at this one, you'll be wasting time, effort, and money. Even if some kind of quantitative goal is achieved, it is still an invalid, dangerous goal. Say you're a salesperson and you've got your number for the week and it's only Wednesday. You might be tempted to think, "Man, I'm great. I'll relax the rest of the week. It's my reward." Worse, what if you don't have your number toward the end of the week? You tend to work harder, not smarter, all in the service of what's not valid anyway. You end up working on the wrong problem or with the wrong activities and habits and dig a deeper hole. And if you're into the win-win thing, you very likely end up making a classic win-win mistake, the unnecessary compromise in the course of changing an invalid goal. That's a killer. In my negotiation coaching experience, and it's pretty broad, ranging over many different fields of business, I've seen that the failure to set manageable goals is as common a mistake as any other. People get confused because they don't have a step-by-step plan. They casually talk about goals and results or objectives, but they don't really know how to distinguish between them. For one thing, they don't have a mission and purpose to guide them. They thereby put themselves on an emotional roller coaster, and this is a fatal error, as we shall see time and again in these pages. Disappointment, excitement, despair, hope. They experience the whole range of emotions, and all because they're reacting to events over which they don't have control, and ignoring those over which they do have control. By following your valid goals, you obtain your objective. By obtaining your objective, you further your mission and purpose. At all times, you set goals and objectives that are as valid as the mission and purpose they serve. It sounds simple, and it is simple to state and to understand, but it takes discipline and practice to actually live and negotiate in this way. You can think of my system and this book as nothing more or less than a means to identify activities and behaviors that we can control during a negotiation. The negotiation never ends. When does a negotiation really end? Conventional wisdom holds that it ends when the deal is put to bed, when the paper is signed, before the ink is even dried. But if this were true, we would never encounter buyer's remorse, would we? We wouldn't need lawyers, or as many lawyers. Customers wouldn't change suppliers. Suppliers wouldn't decide they don't want anything to do with that customer again. In the real world, the negotiation does not end when the paper is signed. Tough negotiators for the multinationals, supply systems management types, operate under the assumption that contracts are easily broken, that this is just part of business, and that their corporations have more legal staying power than the smaller businesses they're dealing with. Take just a minute to think back on some of your most critical negotiations, either in your business or private life. Did they really end, or did they keep going? Some of them kept going, I know that. Now, how did you react? If your goal had been to sign the deal, you were upset, and then you were in trouble, because you didn't know what to do next. But if your goal all along had been behavior and activity over which you had control, you had no problem at all. The first negotiation was now followed by a second negotiation. Back to work. Big deal. Beware unworthy goals. Setting unmanageable goals, those that are beyond your control, is one common mistake. Wasting time and energy on manageable but insufficient or unworthy goals is another. To make my point here, I draw a distinction between what I call pay-side and non-pay-side activities. I apologize for the jargon and the mercenary tone, but the distinction is important, and I haven't figured out a better way to describe it. Pay-side activity is everything directly related to the negotiation, from setting valid appointments and meetings to making the final presentation. Non-pay-side activity is stuff you have to do that isn't directly on the track of negotiation. Filling out expense forms, for example, and other sorts of bureaucratic paperwork are the lowest form of non-pay-side activity. In any event, I think you get the picture. For the salesperson, getting appointments with truly qualified prospects is a pay-side activity, while getting appointments with individuals or companies merely for the sake of fulfilling some mandatory quota is not a pay-side activity. You do have to spend time and energy on non-pay-side activities in order to get to the pay-side, but obviously you want to keep the non-pay-side to the minimum. A downfall of some glad-handing negotiators is to wine and dine potential customers, stop by their offices to shoot the breeze, play golf, send gifts, and so on. All non-pay-side activities, while never making the move to get down to serious negotiating. This is pretty common, actually, in the corporate world, as well as in the more one-on-one professions, such as straight sales. These folks either don't know the difference between pay-side and non-pay-side, or, more likely, they do know the difference very well and are kidding themselves, and using all this non-pay-side whining and dining to avoid what they know will be a difficult negotiation. With non-pay-side activity, there's no immediate gain, but neither is there immediate risk, and this is tempting to us. Pay-side activity does have potential reward, but it also holds risk, and it's hard work. This can thwart us, but we must not let it. On the day that I write these words, I have a meeting that could, in the future, lead to a serious $20 million negotiation. I'm going gladly, but I don't kid myself. It's non-pay-side activity, and I'd set it aside in a moment for a pay-side activity on a negotiation worth only $1 million. One of the characteristics of really successful negotiators is how swiftly and efficiently they shift from non-pay-side activity to pay-side activity. There is great risk in believing, as per conventional wisdom, that certain activity is pay-side when it's actually not. I'm thinking specifically of begging for an appointment, an extremely common error in all fields of business, as I've mentioned. I've seen salespeople almost ruined by this kind of non-pay-side dreaming. A worthwhile appointment with a potential supplier or customer is definitely payside activity. An appointment rustled up out of the phone book to meet some kind of quota is definitely non-payside and a horrible instance of self-deception. This appointment will fail, and so will the next one like it. And pretty soon, no matter how strong you are, your self-image will suffer, and you'll really be in trouble. I mentioned in Chapter 1 the salutary discipline imposed by cold calling, and this is true, but it's non-payside activity. Be sure you understand this. Be sure you don't cold call or do the equivalent if you have a legitimate payside activity waiting. When we have the habit of setting as a goal only activity that we can accomplish and that is genuinely productive, we've taken the first step to getting some real work done. Rather than succeeding or not succeeding almost by accident in the service of some goal that's really beyond our control, we've taken the first step to taking responsibility for our actions and to end what is really self-deception and probably company-wide deception. This may sound harsh, but it's the truth. It's too easy to sell or not sell 50 widgets this week or to sign or fail to sign the contract with your supplier. It's much more difficult to behave and act at all times in a disciplined, systematic way. But this is what you must do in order to achieve what you're capable of. A daily track helps you monitor your work. One of the most challenging skills to learn must be flying the ultra-sophisticated military jet fighters. The training is rigorous, to say the least. This is a completely new environment for a young man or woman just out of college. The oxygen mask and parachute alone are restrictive enough to make you want to vomit. Sitting in a cockpit so small and with straps so tight you can barely move is also stifling. Flying at speeds of 700 miles per hour requires quick, effective decision-making, to say the least again. There's no doubt that death can be instantaneous if the wrong decisions are made, so it's a gross understatement to say the young pilot faces a tremendous challenge. So how does the military, in 12 short months, turn this college graduate into a superb pilot? How does this pilot build the activity and behavior habits necessary to fulfill the goals? Well, when this young man or woman checks into pilot training, one of the first items issued is the daily training folder. That record is carried at all times and reviewed by the instructor, coach, and the flight leader. It'll be reviewed two or three times a day, with constant emphasis on reward for success and focused hard work on the failures. Under the circumstances, good habits are formed very quickly. The training folder will be a lasting document that will grow as the young pilot's career grows. When the career is over, the training folder will become a historical document and part of this pilot's permanent military record. Now, I'm going to scare some of you with the answer to the following question. How do you, as a student of negotiation, turn newly learned activity and behavior into habit? You, too, should keep a daily record and use it to identify strengths and weaknesses. Though this is not a book about psychology, my system does ask the negotiator to study human nature, and it requires that the serious negotiator do so. You must understand and engage the adversary as a psychological being, an approach implicit throughout the previous discussion, and you must engage yourself in the same way. This daily habit of analyzing performance and correcting it is critical to success. It's something that many of us do at least some of the time, sometimes explicitly. And in my hands-on work as teacher and coach, I ask my students to make a commitment to daily active self-examination and assessment, to monitor their behavior and emotions as they affect the negotiating process. Remember Vince Lombardi? Winning isn't everything, but the will to prepare to win is everything. For many people, this daily track, as I call it, is a rigorous task. But I also know that keeping such a daily track would be as valuable in your negotiating work as anything else you might do. The critical assessment of daily actions and decision-making pinpoints weaknesses, works with strengths, and develops self-esteem. This discipline makes you really stop and think how you're spending your time, how you're absorbing this material, and how you're doing as a negotiator. As I've mentioned in the introduction, some theories of learning suggest that we need 800 hours of practice to learn something new and complex. Maybe that's high for some tasks, I don't know, but I do know that we need lots of practice. The daily track helps us get it. I urge you to make the commitment, and in the conclusion of this book, I'll explain how to set up your own daily track for establishing goals you can control and then monitoring how well you've done.